when you started the company, you started what I would call an internet company before there was internet, right? IndiaMART is valued at a little more than 15,000-16,000 crores or somewhere in that ballpark. How was that experience?
You didn't have a lot of phones. Calls would cost you 100 rupees a minute. We got thrown out of a lot of offices.
Yeah.
Ki tum log koi scam kar rahe ho ye.
So zero product market fit.
We got exposed to the power of internet sometime in 95. By the way, we've had 4 or 5 near-death experiences. You can't burn money. Being a Marwadi, you are not allowed to burn anybody's money. Imagine somebody who had not worked on computers,
yeah,
coming in from a small town in UP.
This was magic.
Forget about everything else. How did you figure this out in 20 seconds? And that moment actually, you know, became the aha moment in that sense.
Hi, I'm Sandeep Jethwani, the co-founder of Deserve and the host of the Create Wealth podcast. Today, I'm at home with Brijesh Agarwal, who's co-founder of IndiaMART, one of the earliest listed unicorns in the Indian tech ecosystem. In this conversation with him, I talk about how a company should decide if they should go public, what are the issues in managing a family-run business, how did technology impact his business and the ups and downs of running a successful company. And finally, we also talk about how he invests his own capital. Some really cool insights from this particular podcast. Rich, now today, when I last checked, IndiaMART is valued at a little more than 15,000-16,000 crores or somewhere in that ballpark. When you started the company, you started what I would call an internet company before there was internet, right? And how was that experience of building a B2B marketplace, which is online, in a time when people did not have access to internet? Today, in the post-Jio era, practically every manufacturer would be on an app and can communicate, etc. But back then, maybe that was not so easy. People had desktops. People may not even had computers. So how was that experience and why did you decide to operate in the space to begin with?
So I think we got exposed to the power of internet sometime in 95.
Okay.
And, you know, these are just one or two, let's say, situations that happen around you.
So what happened? How did you discover that?
So in our family, one of our relatives passed away.
Okay.
And his son found shares of some company, which was not an Indian company.
Okay.
And somebody told him that these would be worth millions.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this was in 95, typically. So, you know, during that time period, you didn't have a lot of phones.
Yeah.
Even having a normal
landline
phone was a luxury. You will have long wait lines. So he reached out to us. We reached out to folks that we knew in Bombay and in Calcutta Stock Exchange, because those are the only folks that you would reach out to for figuring out anything about listed companies.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that was happening on letters, some STD phone calls also. Almost 1.5 months had passed by, nothing came by.
Yeah.
And then Dinesh was in US. At that time, we were having a conversation. And when I say conversation, it used to be short conversations because calls would cost you 100 rupees a minute.
Wow.
The ISD calls. And then there was another lady at the back. Aapke 10 second bache call khatam karne ke liye, because you had to book those calls.
Yeah.
So over a call, we were chatting and I happened to tell him about this, that, you know, can you please check with some of your friends who might be in US or in Europe who can help us figure about this company? So he said that, why don't you hold, right? Let me see what I can do. So then I said that, do you really want me to hold? I can call you back. So he said, no, it won't take a lot of time. Just hold on for it. So almost, you know, 15-20 seconds passed by. He was back on the line. And he said that, look, this is the company which was listed on London Stock Exchange, right? This company went bankrupt 4 years ago. This company used to do XYZ products. This was the CEO. This is how things turned out to be. And imagine somebody who had not worked on computers,
yeah,
right? And coming in from a small town.
This was magic.
In UP, it was like, forget about everything else. How did you figure this out in 20 seconds? Right? And that moment actually, you know, became the aha moment in that sense for us. That look, what power does internet bring in?
Mm-hmm.
You can get access to information in seconds, and that information could be from anywhere, any part of the world. So as soon as we started to extrapolate that as to how this will start to impact the lives of a normal common person, we thought that this is going to be one of the most powerful revolutions which are going to come in everybody's lives. And since we come in from a business family background, the first thing that started to click in our heads was that, look, what if the buyers who are sitting in US or Europe, who buy handcrafted products from India, who buy apparel from India, they will buy it at 10 rupees, sell it at 1,000 rupees in those countries. Why can't we become a bridge for them to start finding suppliers or exporters from India?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how that initial idea of building up an online yellow page typically then came in, which converted into a marketplace.
And how hard was it, Brijesh, to convince the sellers to join the platform?
We were infatuated with internet because of this incident. And like every other youth who's infatuated, you continue to do things which, when you look back, would be the most stupid things ever. So we started off with the business in 96, 1st April, Fool's Day. And probably, I think we were big fools to have started off at that time, because when we spent time on the ground, we realized there were only 500 internet connections in India. In India. Forget about Delhi. Across India, VSNL had sold only 500 odd internet connections. Internet was launched on 15th August 95.
Wow.
Right? And 7.5 months later, you launched this business. An online B2B marketplace. Right? It was such a rude shock for us that, you know, wherever you would go, they don't know about internet. Secondly, if you even want to show them, you know, what internet is, how do you show it to them? Because they don't have a landline with them. Right? They don't have a router. They don't know what is a dial-up connection.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if you carried our credentials, the routers, how do you get that phone line? Because without which you just cannot connect. You cannot carry a phone line with you.
Yeah.
There were no mobile phones available to do internet connection there. So in fact, we got thrown out of a lot of offices. Ki tum log koi scam kar rahe ho ye, which we don't understand what this is. Right? So people said, we are not interested in listening to you. So early on, the first 6 months, by the way, we could not convince even one single customer to come in on our platform and start generating leads from these markets.
So zero product market fit in the early days.
Product market fit in early days. And in fact, if you see what we do today, this product market fit actually came in 2014.
Wow.
Which is 18 years after we started off. In between, we pivoted 2-3 times.
So in that first year, the family didn't say ki wapas aa jao dhande mein, ye sab kya kar rahe ho?
In fact, we were the ones who sort of were feeling ki ye kuch ho to raha nahi hai. And you can't burn money. Matlab, being a Marwadi, you are not allowed to burn anybody's money. Right? So we thought we may not be able to do this. Why don't we sort of pack up, go back home?
Yeah.
We have a family business of petroleum products, and we have petrol pumps. So I called up my grandfather and I told him that we are not able to do much here. It looks like we may come back.
Sure.
Our family was a joint family, large family. Almost 50 of us used to live in one house. So there were a lot of people who were involved in the family business. And my grandfather was dead against you know, any more people joining that business, because he understood that if there are too many people in one business, someday the family will fall apart. So he was always of the opinion that you go ahead and do something on your own. So when, you know, called him, he obviously figured out that all of us are fairly distressed here.
Yeah.
But he still was cool and calm, and he said, don't worry about it. Let me ask you a couple of questions. And then we take a decision based upon that as to what needs to be done. And by the way, those two questions finally became the biggest learning that we've had in our professional life ever. So his first question was that, I don't know what is internet. I don't know what is computer. I don't know what you do.
Mm.
But whatever you go back and do, is it valuable to anybody? And does it bring in benefit for any person?
Amazing.
He said, yes, yeah. It does. Exporters need to find buyers outside the country. The only medium that they have right now is to participate in a trade show or have their own sales team.
Yeah.
Or do some advertisements in Exporters Yellow Pages. All of these are very, very expensive. So, you know, they will be able to get a lot of benefit out of this internet platform. He said, okay, fair enough. The second question is, do you think that they will benefit from it? Or do they think that they will benefit from it? So, at first, the question was a bouncer for me. I didn't understand what did he mean to ask. So I requested him to explain. He explained, right. And then, you know, we told him that wherever we would go, a lot of people turn their back on us. But a lot of people also said that, have you done this for somebody? It looks interesting, looks promising. But why don't you do it for 4 or 5 folks first and then come to us and we'll be happy to then take it up. So as soon as, the second question was answered, he said, so problem solved. You yourself are saying that what you're building is of value to somebody. And the only thing that those folks are waiting for is that they have examples of people to whom that value has been given. You tell me, if somebody comes to you, sells something for 100 rupees, which is worth 110 rupees to you, will you buy it or not? That's what you do in trading.
Correct.
100 ka kharido, 110 ka bech do. So if you are going to buy that, right? Similarly, the other guy will also buy. If he's paying you 100 bucks and he's getting value worth 110, he will buy it.
Yeah.
So the only thing that matters right now is time. It's just a matter of time before some of these people will come back, have faith in you, right? Those will be your early believers. And then you build business on top of that. So this is how he convinced us to stay back. And he said, look, don't worry about your food, stay. And if you're tired of traveling in on bike and buses, right? So I'll send money for food. I'll give you money to stay in the house. I'll also send my Maruti 800 so that you don't have to travel by bus, right? But you stay back. Don't come here.
Nowadays, there's a term for this, incubator or accelerator. Like that's what they do. But even after that, Rajesh, if this was 1996, 2000 was probably the worst crash that internet businesses have seen in our lifetime. I think 2020, when COVID happened, it actually boomed. Even the one right now, 2022, was not as bad as what happened in 2000.
Correct.
And I know a lot of internet businesses folded up at that time and never came back into the internet era. The
Correct.
Founders probably found jobs in other businesses. How was that particular experience and how did IndiaMART survive through that?
So, by the way, we've had 4 or 5 near-death experiences and until as late as 2017.
Okay.
Right. So there are moments like these which that did come in. First, obviously, was in 96 itself. Then the second one was when 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
At that time, travel as a sector contributed almost 3/4 of our revenues.
How was that? Like, what was exactly the product that was working?
So the travel agents would attract foreign inward travelers, FITs.
Got it.
And they would list their services on our platform.
Makes
we will
sense.
Help them get access sure. to those travelers. 9/11 happened.
So overnight, everything shut down.
Everything shut down. The entire revenue flow was off. Everybody took off their advertisements. Period over. We were in a terrible, obviously, cash flow crisis because we didn't have money to pay even the salaries for that matter. It took us almost like 6-9 months to start refocusing on other sectors, generating revenues from there, and then streamline even payment of salaries on a timely basis to the team altogether. But what it did, teach us is that relying on one particular sector essentially for driving revenues may never be a good thing. There may be a, sunrise sector which gives you that bump initially. But what it also means is you have to quickly go back and find the second or the third so that the percentage contribution that you get from any each of those sectors that actually gets reduced.
Got it.
And you have de-risked that entire model.
Sure.
So changing that focus from where we were getting the 70-75% revenues from travel to a business where we started to focus on industrial goods, automobile spare parts. That change, by the way, was an excellent change for us. As a business, I think it just opened our own eyes on what could be done.
Yeah. And like, what were some of the other pains that happened? Like you mentioned that there were three or four such incidents.
Then Lehman crisis.
Yeah.
The entire export-import business essentially took
seized
a tumble.
In a way. Yeah.
Right. And manufacturing in India anyway was not growing as heavily. So that became a crisis. Then we had started off a B2B e-commerce venture in 2015, right? That entire venture was the most cash-guzzling venture that we ever went into. So the cash balance that we had at that time versus what the business was taking up, it seemed that we didn't have a runway for even 6 months available.
Sure.
So we've had all those kinds of moments, and at each of these different kinds of experience or moments, we've taken a different route to eventually come out of it and solve for it for the long run.
It almost seems like through this journey, there was no thinking of a plan B at any point of time, that if this is not working, I'll go and do something else. Because if multiple such near-death experiences happen, at some point you feel, why am I like sweating it out so much? I'll do something much more comfortable.
Honey, apart from these near-death experiences, you also have an experience that you've been in this business for 15-20 years and a six-year-old company goes out and becomes a $5 billion value business.
I want to talk about that as well. Yeah.
So Brijesh, as you were talking about these near-death experiences, alongside there would have been a situation where there were some companies started very recently, especially in the e-commerce space, which would have like galloped ahead in terms of valuation or even public frenzy or interest around them. How is it to run a real business in that environment? Because you're also competing for talent in some cases with these kind of companies.
So obviously, these all come in as big distractions. And it depends upon an individual's maturity on how you really go ahead and start handling it. Because on one side, you may want to stick to doing what you're doing. On the other side, you think about, look, if I don't make this change and tomorrow what I'm doing doesn't scale up, doesn't work the way I'm thinking it will work, then I would look like somebody who missed the opportunity. So there is that constant discussion, debate, which is going on internally.
Yeah.
Ki what is to be done? Fortunately for us, we always understood one thing, that doing anything for the consumer is out of our DNA.
Yeah, so meaning a B2C business is out of the DNA.
Because we don't understand consumers as well.
Sure.
So even if we made an attempt to do something like that, potentially we would never be able to do it well. Second, for us, going ahead and let's say raising capital, etc., had always been a problem. As I said, we were not great storytellers, and while there were investors who will come meet with us, look at the data and everything else, they would always find some or the other reason to say that, we cannot invest. So we also said any business which requires high cash burn is again out of our league.
Sure.
Right? We can't do it. This again is not natural us who will be able to do it. So while there were a lot of these businesses which came in and which did impact us mentally, that they've raised so well ahead of us. But frankly, we realized, what is it that we could do better? And we said that what we cannot do, we should definitely not do it. Right. So in that sense, it narrowed down again to the point that what we were doing is was a large enough market. Maybe it takes a little longer time period.
Mm.
But if we continue to do it well, we could again create something which is of great value.
That's a high degree of self-awareness in this process. Vijesh, one of the interesting things about IndiaMart is that not only was it an internet company, but also that it was in some sense family run by the two of you, Dinesh and yourself. And especially during ups and downs, especially in family run businesses, the relationship also gets tested because you don't leave your work in the office. You come back, families are intertwined. What's your advice for family run businesses in terms of setting up processes, or how should you really work with a family member?
So I think, thankfully for us, two things happened very, very well right from the word go.
Mm.
One is that we actually had a very strong family bond, because as I said, 50 of us living in one family, and where to the extent that you will not believe, Dinesh Bhaiya's son didn't know that I was not his real chacha until he was in class 8th.
Incredible.
Right. So one, the family environment that we got, we never actually discussed this word cousin at all. So we had fairly strong family bond, and come what may, our matlab grandparents to our parents, there was no option of moving out of the family in that sense.
Sure.
So you have to do whatever within this premise itself. So even if you have disputes, even if you have disagreements, right, the only way is that you have to find a way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even if you were to go back to our family and tell them that, look, this is not working out, right, nobody's going to listen to us. Go make it work. That is how it is. So we never thought about even taking that route.
Sure.
Right? There were disagreements. There were moments wherein there were differences in the way we wanted to do this, but eventually one of us gave way to the other.
And how would you decide a tiebreaker situation in that kind of a case?
So this is a situation where mutually things happen, and then comes a case where mutually it doesn't come to an agreement.
Sure.
And I think at that time the hierarchy of an organization that typically comes into play, which needs to be agreed upon between the family members at one go.
Hmm.
That if it comes to that point, whose word will count?
Hmm.
Right? And between us, this was something which was established from day one very clear.
Got it.
Right? Ki, we should do this between ourselves. Otherwise, during these difficult times, it will become very, very hard for anybody to run the business. And thankfully for us, I was the younger one. And as our family hierarchy goes, right, the elder one always goes ahead and takes the lead. It was his idea. He had figured out internet in the US. He's 7 years elder to me, had much better view on the business. I was just 19 and a half when we started off. So in that sense, the hierarchy, when it came down to making decisions, was absolutely clear.
Got it.
As long as we can mutually decide, it's fair enough. Otherwise, this comes into play. So that has to be defined between the family members as a must-have thing. If it is not defined,
mm-hmm.
it will at some point in time lead to, let's say, a dispute,
yeah.
which may not be resolvable.
And because, you know, we talk to a lot of family business owners, there are issues around ownership also, right? Because at the end of the day, some of these, while they are family businesses, when the shareholding pattern is being drawn up, there has to be a number put against every name, etc. In those kind of decisions, how should families deal with it?
One of the things that I've also seen is that when you're building up a business, your entire family cannot be involved in the business.
Okay.
Right. Generally, we prefer that if you have two folks, that's an ideal team to be involved. If there are any more family members who are getting involved,
mm-hmm.
right? You may want to do it only for a very short period of time and not in terms of ownership,
yeah,
but only in terms of somebody coming in and working.
A specific role or something.
A specific role where they use it as a platform to start their career.
Sure.
They may grow as a professional inside the business, or else they would want to move out and do something on their own.
Got it.
You cannot have lots of owners sitting inside a business.
Yeah.
You may still have lots of shareholders, but you will not have lots of people running the business per se.
Got it.
Right. So in that sense, two, at best three, right? Though ideal, I would still say two is fairly sufficient. Anything beyond that generally is avoidable. So that's one thing that families should go ahead and do. Second, let the decision making about the business be left to the people who are actually on that ground. You can have updates, you can have MISs, all of that bit in, but the way you would go ahead and leave the day-to-day decisions to the management team which is running the business, right? You will have to leave it to them, because shareholding versus people running the business, that is something that has to be distinguished clearly.
Sure.
If one has to really avoid making these kinds of mistakes or having heartburns later where you actually lose a family because of a successful business.
Absolutely. And that's a less than ideal situation. Brijesh, in IndiaMART, the one of the most exciting things is you have a vantage point on India's economy in terms of what is happening in the manufacturing space or how our MSMEs doing. What are some of these interesting trends or things which are not obvious from the outside world? Which are sectors which are like doing really well at this point, or where there are business opportunities from where you see them today?
Okay, let me try and answer this a little differently, because some of this data may not be in the public domain. So that is something that I will not be able to go back and share.
Sure.
But one thing that we've really looked at from the trends of people who are coming in and posting RFQs, you do get a sense on what is a sunrise sector. So let's say if you would, during the times of COVID, the search volumes for COVID-related medicines, COVID-related, let's say, items like sanitizers, etc., you could see that these had already started to go up even before the lockdown was introduced.
Interesting.
Right. So you start to get those early signs when something is really picking up. You know, things like EV for that matter, right? As a sector, this is something which is booming.
Yeah.
And, you know, you will see a reflection of that being felt when you look at the IndiaMART data. So the sectors which we already know of, which are doing well, they would definitely be there. But then, yes, there are some of these sectors which you would see as upcoming sectors.
Mm-hmm.
There are sectors that you would start to look at which may not be known to us. So, for example, if you know we were to go back and ask you what is the most searched product on IndiaMART, I can say 100% you know, with guarantee that you will not be able to tell me what that product is.
Yeah.
Right. One would think about it as, let's say, mobile phones.
Yeah.
Right.
Or some electronics of some other kind. But yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, but when you hear of things like a papad making machine.
Is the most searched product on.
It is one of the most searched products.
Oh, incredible.
Right. So those are things which are like, okay, where is it being used?
Okay.
Right. Who actually wants that?
Yeah.
Right. And then you see the amount of these, you know, small business units, which we call as Laghu Udyog or Grah Udyog. You will see that their numbers are phenomenally large.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are self-entrepreneurs, small groups of people who would use this, make products, sell it on their livelihood.
Ties in with the Mudra loan disbursements which are happening. So potentially there's some of that there. Yeah. Interesting. So you're saying that maybe there are household businesses which are emerging within India, which at the pace which was probably not happening earlier.
The bigger ones we all know largely, but I'm saying the ones which are currently at a small pace, there are tons of these different kinds of businesses
mm-hmm.
which typically are being built and very interesting work is happening in those areas.
Yeah. There's one point I wanted to go back to, Brijesh, when you spoke about like capital usage and especially in IndiaMART's own journey, you've raised only $30 million of equity capital. And traditionally, Indian businesses have been very capital efficient. But at the same time, there are now large businesses which have been built on the back of large VC capital. And they've, in some cases, burned through that capital. In some cases, they've burned through and now turned profitable. Do you have a mental model around how entrepreneurs should think about capital and what is the right amount of capital a business should consume before it gets to profitability?
So I think, again, different people will have different views around it.
Mm.
A lot of it depends on what is your own DNA. What is it that you are comfortable with? What is it that gels well with your own value system, your risk-taking ability for that matter? So for us, for example, borrowing money, whether it is debt or taking equity, was, you know, such a big decision
mm-hmm.
that even when you took equity, it was like, why did you have to take it? Why did you have to take somebody else's money at all in this business? That's the kind of question which you can expect back home
yeah.
being asked, right? Why can't you build a business which runs on its own? Why is it that you need to build it so fast?
Yeah.
Right? So, the environment in which we've sort of been born and brought up and then studied at school, college, the kind of friends, etc. that you've made, I think a lot of that essentially determines that even if you were to approach the same business, and, you know, there are different sets of people who will say, nahi, this approach will work better than the other one.
Mm-hmm.
The approach for a founder that I have seen work best is what actually aligns well with your own thinking and your own comfort.
Got it.
Now, when you, let's say, get aligned to this idea that I can actually use large sums of capital to take bigger bets, move fast, test things out, you know, in shorter span of time, do multiple experiments at one point in time, you may want to go ahead and start looking at building up this business with tons of capital.
Sure.
But if you're not comfortable, right, there will be that alternative way wherein you keep building your business without doing this big bang change. You know, in banking, for example, everybody said without technology, you know, no banks will be able to really do well. HDFC kept on defying everyone, right? Their consumer-facing technology is something which is the, I think, the most old-school technology that you would ever get to yeah. see.
And they're still rolling out branches right now.
Right? They continue to do that. Mm. They continue to serve a segment of customer which only wants to do it with them.
Got it.
They have a value proposition which is incredible, right? So in that sense, there are a lot of ways in which you can go ahead and look at building up business within the same ecosystem.
Hmm.
There are some businesses which do require lots and lots of capital because there are those big daddies which are really coming in. When you look at, let's say, an e-com play, you need substantial amount of capital because you have, let's say, somebody like Amazon who's willing to put in, you know, billions of dollars into the business,
mm-hmm.
you with, you know, 10 million, 20 million, 50 million may not be able to fight that because they can kill it with money. There is very other little differentiator that you can bring in as compared to them. But wherever there could be a differentiating factor, I think you will have an opportunity to go back and build the capital efficient way. As a founder, at least I draw comfort that I don't have to really go back and explain every single decision to an investor who is not operating the business.
Yeah.
Right? An investor does bring in valuable insights, right? For example, when we had to construct our first board, had it not been for Intel Capital, right, we wouldn't have been able to get folks like Nachiket Mohr at all. Right. And he did transform us as better entrepreneurs, post coming on the board. So there are certain things which each of us can really do well. When it comes to running the business, taking decisions about the the day-to-day elements of the business, or deciding on what is the best strategic route to achieve a certain outcome, I don't think that non-operators can really go back and do it. They will only be kind of rolling the dice. But we have to take a final call, because ultimately it's our responsibility what goes well, what goes wrong inside
the
business.
It's your business, and it's your responsibility to them as well.
So as entrepreneurs, as founders, I would always have a larger skin in the game, a bigger neck in the business, so that the investor also gets this comfort that if there is something wrong that goes, I am the biggest loser. The founder is the biggest loser, not the investor.
Yeah,
that again starts to give comfort, and you get the space to build the business. When you cede this space to others, is when instructions come from people who are not operating the business, and that's a slightly dangerous situation to be in. So either you're able to manage your investors so well that you, despite having a lesser skin in the game, you still can continue to build the business the way you want it. So that independence has to be there, and dilution has to be looked at accordingly. The best business, for example, which I admire, is Zoho.
Yeah.
Zero capital, right? Completely run professionally now.
Yeah.
Sells to all across the world, right? Billions of dollars of revenues, $500 million worth of profit.
Yeah, and right. Mr. Vembu can operate out of rural Tamil Nadu.
Wherever he would want to. Yeah. See, that's the most incredible kind of business one can really think of. Look at Zerodha for that matter. They don't have to answer to anybody.
Yeah.
Right? So if you can build something like that, that's the best outcome.
Yeah.
And then if you have to build a business where you only are left with 1 or 2% stake in the business, that will come last in the priority for me.
There's some very interesting things you said there, Brijesh. So first is that the business should have a differentiating factor. Otherwise, capital will erode the business. Somebody else's capital will come in and eat you up. The second was that whether you are bootstrapped or VC funded is a function of your own DNA. And third, even if you are VC funded, you should keep an eye for your dilution so that you have enough skin in the game. So if you don't have that, then there is no interest in the business. Brijesh, you yourself have been an investor in multiple businesses, including some businesses which are VC funded. So from public information, whatever research we put together, you're an investor in Ola or ShipRocket and some of these kind of companies. Do you have a approach to figuring out which are the right businesses that you should back?
See, most of these personal investments that we've gone ahead and made have been made because we know the founders, right? And when that opportunity came in to invest, one would invest a certain amount there.
Sure.
Otherwise, we don't have as much time with us to really act like a proper angel investor, build up a team, spend time in evaluating businesses, because we are still very hands-on in our business.
Sure.
So in that sense, the overall approach so far largely has been to at least be associated with those companies where you've known the founders or you've known some of the senior team members. In a sense, you also have the opportunity to learn how they are doing things in their business, how they are solving some of these problems in their business. So that is what personal investments
are. It's very interesting. A lot of entrepreneurs, when we talk to them, they think about investing in other businesses as tuition fees, like that they are paying. But what are the founder traits? Since you said that knowing the founder is important, what are the founder traits that allow you to build comfort with that particular company?
So one thing that I personally prefer is that somebody has to be very, very straight. Right? Good, bad, ugly. It has to come all in same tone.
Yeah.
Right? One doesn't have to be defensive, because as long as you don't have comfort in sharing what is going on inside the business, there is always this possibility that something will be hidden. So transparency comes into play. The other element that does come into play is that these founders should be trying to solve a problem which is either a very big problem or is very meaningful, even though for a small set of people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So either it should have more impact or it should have possibility of scale there. So a couple of these investments, for example, would be in deep tech businesses which are being built and are at the R&D stage itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there are professors in universities who are trying to do something. If that problem is solved, India will benefit tremendously. If it doesn't get solved, your money is lost.
Mm.
Right? But it's very still, binary outcomes. Yeah. You would want to really go back and do it, not from the perspective as to what is the IRR that you're going to get on top of that. But yeah. It's like you want to assist people who are trying to solve these problems, which could have a very large impact on the overall country. So that's the approach.
Brijesh, this has been very insightful. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for your time.
Naini, thank you so much for having me here.